Okay, we're back. Sorry about that. Took a while to get things going. Basic probability theory is based on numerical assessments of likelihood of events, as we mentioned, and these events are treated using set theory. They can be combined and analyzed as sets are. Sets can be described as explicit lists of elements one by one. An example of that in the Chairman problem is the event Anne or Carol, Anne, comma, Carol, or as collections that satisfy properties such as female candidates. Element lists aren't very useful in probability theory, although we use them in examples a lot. We're usually more interested in sets that are described as satisfying a property because that connects events to logical propositions, the kinds of things that we want to talk about scientifically. We use the rules of logic to combine events defined by such properties of the elements of sets we think of as events. However, it's also convenient in many cases to think in terms of combining these events as sets. Rather than using logical notation of implication and so on in talking about events, although we use them in words, in describing them in terms of probability theory, we typically use set notation, and that's relatively convenient for the mathematics of probabilities. Another concept that we haven't mentioned yet is that of a partition. A partition is a set of non-empty events such that the union of all of the events is the certain event, is the event that is sure to happen, and so that no two events in the partition intersect. So usually we would say that the event that the chairman is female with the event that the chairman is male is a partition of the candidate set. And since all of the candidates together make up the possibilities for the chairman, that is certain to happen. It's useful to consider all possible intersections of events, which give events that have relatively few elements, or in other words, they satisfy very precise descriptions of all the properties that pertain to those events. Ping. Probability obeys some convenient mathematical laws. We mentioned that to get numerical values, however, we need to assess probabilities. And I mentioned that there are these three approaches, the frequency approach, the symmetry approach, or the subjective approach. We have some new examples here. The frequency approach is often used in at least crude weather prediction. If you look at certain measurements of the weather instruments like the barometer and the temperature and so on, you can often give a fairly good prediction of what's going to happen over the next few hours in terms of the weather. The symmetry approach we've already mentioned, and the example of rolling a die, of course, is the one we already used. Finally, in the case of the subjective approach, we mentioned that we can use revealed preference. That's not a word I used before, but it's very common for economists to work with revealed preference. That is, if we watch the agent, they can bet on these two events, A and B, and the agent chooses A rather than B, and we know that they have the same payoff to the agent, then we expect that the agent assesses a higher subjective probability that A is going to occur. As I mentioned before, subjective probabilities are not necessarily uninformed by history, but they necessarily do involve some mental activity by the agent, and typically we talk about subjective probabilities when we don't understand the agent's history, the agent's thought process, and so on. And so we just say, well, they have these numerical probabilities. You're probably familiar with operations on sets, but let me describe them in detail. The notation A cup B, the upward pointing U, means union. And this is the set of things that are members of at least one of A or B, and if both, you only count that one once. In the case of A cap B, the upside down U, we call that intersection. And the intersection of A and B is the set of things that are members of both A and B. A little bit different from intersection is the set difference. This is the set of members of A that are not members of B. And finally, we have subset, which is where every element of A is also an element of B if A is a subset of B. We sometimes also talk about supersets, but where we have the opposite relationship. A is a superset of B if every element of B is an element of A as well. So if we have two sets, A and B, where A is scissors, paper, stone, and B is needle, thread, and scissors, this is somewhat incoherent because they come from different domains, obviously. Scissors, paper, stone is about the game. Needles, thread, and scissors is about the activity of sewing. And we really shouldn't do this, but if we think of these just as words, as strings of characters, then we can reasonably ask about their set theoretic relationships. This is something that's really important in doing scientific work. We use mathematics, and the mathematics operates on symbols. These symbols do not necessarily have the same meaning in one context as they do in another, and yet we put them together. So for example, a common thing that people might do is be interested in both height and weight of a person. But adding both height and weight together, even though they're both numbers, you might have a person who is 157 centimeters tall and weighs 50 kilograms, but adding those two numbers to get 207 doesn't mean anything. And this happens a lot in informal thinking about things. Keeping these units straight is something that we try to do in mathematics. Now, although we can't add those two, it might make sense to look at something like the ratio. If we divide the weight by the height, then we get some notion of the density of the person in some sense. But the units there are not either centimeters or kilograms, they're kilograms per centimeter. And in fact, the so-called basal metabolic index, the BMI, is something similar to that. I believe, however, it's weight divided by height squared. Now, since humans all have basically the same proportion, you would expect that height and the cross-section, the area of the cross-section of a human, is about proportional or something, proportional to height squared. And so that's why they do basal metabolic index that way. Here, we're just going to consider scissors, paper, stone as three words, and needle, thread, and scissors as three words, and then perform our operations on them. So, for example, the union of A and B is scissors, paper, stone, needle, and thread. Scissors does not get repeated twice. The intersection is scissors, and the difference between A and B is paper and stone, right? The fact that needle and thread aren't in A is not of interest to us. There's another concept called the symmetric difference that's sometimes used in set theory, but it's not usually important in probability theory. Finally, the subset relationship is a little bit different from the others. It's not actually an operation. It is a relation or a predicate. And since needle and thread are not elements of, excuse me, since paper and stone, which are in A, are not elements of B, A is not a subset of B. Similarly, since needle and thread are not elements of A, B is not a subset of A. So neither A subset B or B subset A is true. And that's a little bit different from the others, where we can always do the operation. So for example, if we take A intersect B and A subtract B, the set difference, then we have these sets, scissors and paper stone. If we try to take the intersection, we get nothing, the empty set. If we try to take the set difference, again, we get nothing because they don't intersect with each other. Oh, excuse me. If we take the set difference, then we get whatever is on the left-hand side. So since scissors is not in paper and stone, if we subtract scissors from paper and stone, we get paper and stone again. Since paper and stone are not in the set scissors, if we subtract paper and stone from the set scissors, then we get scissors again. A little confusing, but not that hard to figure out. And a little bit more easy to understand when you think about it in terms of set operations rather than working with the elements themselves. Now, when we talk about events, we often use somewhat different vocabulary. In particular, when we talk about events, we often say that A union B is the disjunction of A and B. Either the event where this is the event where the event described by A or the event described by B, or both of them happen at the same time. The event A intersect B is conjunction. This is the event where both the event described by A and the event described by B happen at the same time. A subtract B is exclusion, and this is the event where A occurs but B does not. The event or the relationship of implication where A is a subset of B means that if A happens, B is guaranteed to happen as well. So if we take the subset of the candidates for chairman, AN, this set that contains only AN is a subset of the set of female candidates. So if AN happens, then a female candidate becomes chairman. So the logical implication is perfectly represented by the set theoretic representation. The null event, also represented as an empty pair of braces, means nothing happens, or the impossible event, or the empty event. Nothing is impossible because if you have an event where everything stays the same as before an event was supposed to happen, this is actually an event. This is a logical description of what happened. Things stayed the same. Nothing happens means that time hasn't passed yet. So, since we know that time always passes, the event where none of the things that we've described as possible happen is impossible. Obviously, this means that in order to work with probabilities, we have to describe everything that's possible. And if something that's impossible happens, we have to reject our model entirely. So, for example, you might have a probabilistic model where interest rates are always positive. And to an economist, this makes a lot of sense, because in the real world, we always have cash. And cash is always guaranteed. Since cash is the measure of value, that's defined by the idea that the government gets to tell us what money is. So cash always is valuable, and it always has the, it's always the measure of value. And so if we borrow, or if we lend money and got negative interest, then it would make sense to just keep cash, right? So economists often assume that interest rates have to be positive, but we've discovered recently that interest rates are not necessarily positive. Japan has run negative interest rates in certain borrowing and lending markets, where the amounts of cash involved are so large that nobody could practically accomplish it. So when banks are borrowing money from the from each other or from the government in order to cover their shortfalls for reserve requirements or things like that, this is amounts of money in the billions or sometimes even trillions of dollars or yen or dollars. And that amount of cash, even if you use the largest available bills, at least in Japan, the largest bill is Ichimonen. I'm not sure what it is in America, but I think it's like $1,000, which is much bigger. Not $1,000, but $100,000, although you don't see those in actual circulation. However, normally we only see $100 bills or 10,000 yen bills, which are about equal value. And if you think of what a billion of those to get to $100 billion, which, or 100 billion, well, yeah, $100 billion or the equivalent number of yen, I guess that's a trillion yen. A billion pieces of paper is a heck of a lot of paper. And banks are not going to want to be moving that around, if not least because it would be targeted by gangs in North Korea and stuff like that. So what do economists with a probabilistic model that assumes that interest rates have to be positive? Or recently we actually saw certain prices go negative. Now, the prices that went negative are in fact in derivative markets, which have a similar property that it's actually, it's impractical to move that kind of cash around. It's actually impossible in the particular derivative markets, the futures markets, to move things around in the right way to actually arbitrage. So in fact, in a futures market, you really should prepare for negative prices because it's possible that that could happen. Anyway, what happens to your scientist when something that they've modeled as probability zero or impossible actually happens? Well, they cry. That's all they can do. They have to go back and start over again. The opposite of the null event is the certain event. If you've listed all the possibilities, then something happens among those possibilities is certain to happen. And we can always create a certain event by saying, here's our list of things that we believe can happen, and then add to that the event something else. Now, you may have trouble coming up with a reasonable probability for something else, but at least it's in your model if you do that. So now we can talk about some of the rules that we have for probabilities. First, as I said before, every event has a probability or number assigned to it. In mathematics, this is called a set function or a function of sets. We also have set valued functions, but I don't think we're going to meet those in this class, or at least not soon. So this is a set function because the things you put into it are sets and something comes out, in this case, numbers. The probability of an event, which we will call E, is denoted P of E. And sometimes P is spelled PR or PROB. Also, I like to use square brackets for this, but often you'll see round brackets, ordinary parentheses, used for this. The set of all events, of all elements of all events that we're interested in, is called the certain event or the sure event, and it's often denoted by omega. The probability of omega is always 1. The empty set is called the impossible event and has a probability of 0. The reason for this is that we're going to eventually get probabilities by adding up numbers. And it turns out that in mathematics, it's convenient to define the idea of adding up no numbers. If you add no numbers, you started with 0 and you end up with 0. Does this make sense? Well, if you only have one number, then you haven't added anything. Suppose that number is 1. Well, if we add 1 to 0, we get 1 again, so starting with 0 doesn't hurt us. If we add 1 and 2, we get 3. But if we say, okay, really we don't have any number 1, we just have the idea of adding 1. Well, then if we, and the same thing for 3. If we start with 0 and we add 1, we get 1. If we then add 3, we get 4, just as if we added 1 and 4. This may sound like nonsense, but it turns out to be convenient that if you add up a bunch of things and that bunch has nothing in it, then the answer is 0. Mathematics uses this kind of idea a fair amount. This empty set is called the impossible event, and it's denoted by either empty brackets or by the 0 with a slash through it, which is called null. And it always has a probability of 0. So these are the two boundaries. We have the certain event, which has a probability of 1, and we have the impossible event, which has a probability of 0. Economists and mathematicians sometimes talk about impossible things by saying the probability of that happening is 0. And this is where that comes from. Probability 0, it turns out, has a slightly different meaning from impossible. But in practice, it really doesn't make a difference. As I mentioned, probabilities are not determined by mathematical theorems. The probability of any given event is something that we have to measure empirically, or we can deduce it from assumptions sometimes, or estimate it subjectively. However, there are certain laws of probability. We've already mentioned two of them. The probability of the empty set, or the null event, is equal to 0, and the probability of the certain event is equal to 1. It's also the case that the probability of any event is at least as big as 0 and never greater than 1. If A is a subset of B, then it's always true that the probability of A is no bigger than the probability of B. And finally, we have the addition axiom. If A and B have no intersection, if it's impossible for them to happen together, then the probability of at least one of them happening is equal to the probability of A plus the probability of B. And that's true for all events A and B. If they happen to intersect, if there's some possibility that they happen together, then they're not the null set. The union is not the null set, and so the second part, the then part, doesn't apply. If they do have the intersection of the null set, if it's impossible for them to happen together, then the addition rule applies. This is a sufficient set of axioms for countable omega. And there are many other probability laws that can be deduced from this very small set of axioms for probability. Note that none of these laws actually refer to the elements. The elements could be anything. It was convenient for us in our model of the chairman problem that our elements were the actual names of the people. But note that a name can't be a chairman. A name can only be the name of a person who's a chairman. And we gave them different names because we wanted to use a standard six-sided die to make the choice. So we gave them the names 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. We could also make a spinner with equal amounts for 6 different colors, red, blue, yellow, green, orange, purple, and I don't remember, whatever, anyway, 6 different colors, and then use those. We could even have these basic events, the partition, be, we could think of this as a circle. The outside of our spinner is a circle, and so each point on the outside of the circle, the one that comes down, we divide those into 6 intervals on the circumference of that circle. So to talk about probabilities, we don't really need to talk about the elements of our events. Sometimes it's convenient to do so. And usually when we talk about as an element, we call it something like omega. And if we have a very small number of elements, such as our Chairman problem, we might name them explicitly. But our mathematics of events does not depend on those. And that becomes important when we have continuous variables. I want to say a little bit more about the Schur event. It's very common in probability modeling to use uniform probability. Wait, let's stop there.